Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is my regular co-host, Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you this week?
Well, I'm all right. All things considered in Cleveland, I'm doing okay.
Yeah, me too. Still lamenting. Anyway, it's another story. But before we get with to this week's stories, I want to thank everyone who's already taken the very quick and easy Politics Guys survey at survey.libsyn.com/politicsguys. If you haven't already, we would really appreciate it if you could do that. It's going to be very helpful to us, and I promise you, literally 30 seconds, unless you are a super slow typer, that is. In that case, maybe a minute. Again, that's survey.libsyn.com/politicsguys, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. Thanks very much. All right, moving on, our first story this week. Let's talk about, some important developments in U.S. trade policy. Early in the week, President Trump announced that he would go ahead with $50 billion in tariffs on Chinese imports, as well as tougher limits on Chinese investments in high-tech U.S. industries. Then this was followed a few days later by the president's announcement that he would not be renewing the steel and aluminum tariff waivers that had been granted to Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. Now, these tariffs, which the administration has legally justified on the highly questionable grounds of national security, they're 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum. Now, the EU has already said that it's going to respond with equivalent tariffs on U.S. goods, as well as take their case to the World Trade Organization, and we're expecting similar retaliation from Canada and Mexico. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on all this?
I think it's sort of a train wreck. As a free trade conservative, this has always been the big concern with Donald Trump. Well, I shouldn't say the big concern.
One of them.
the big policy related concern with Donald Trump is that he just doesn't get free trade, and that he's willing to take these protectionist steps that history teaches backfire. So I'll tell you, I've gone through sort of a process with this. Originally when he was campaigning, and he would say, I'm going to slap tariffs on, and I've said, this is awful, this is terrible. Then he announced he didn't do it for a while, and everything seemed cool, and they announced he was going to do it. And he said, okay, I'm doing it, but I'm not really doing it. I'm giving it a waiver. And now he's unwaiving the waiver. So it's not entirely clear to me if this is actually his trade policy or if this is just more tough negotiation, but I find it troubling. And again, more on the Canadian, Mexican, European front, because I think the Chinese, that's a different problem. I don't get it. And I certainly hope for the sake of the country and for the sake of Republican prospects in the fall that he's not leading us into a trade war with our closest allies.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is just part of a number of, similar moves. I mean, he ordered a little while ago, he ordered the Commerce Department to see whether or not we should put new tariffs on imported vehicles and also for national security reasons.
Yeah.
And there's a study that came out recently that said that if that happens, the U.S. automobile industry is going to lose something like 195,000 jobs. Of so many of the ridiculous things that the president does, I think this is right up there at the top. I mean, this is a real job killer, as the Chamber of Commerce has said, as a number of Republicans have said, as Ben Sasse said, make America great again shouldn't mean make America 1929 again, and I think this is, absolutely the case. And certainly there is a real issue here. The real issue is that, at least in this particular instance, is that China has vastly overproduced steel, and that's depressed prices worldwide. But that this is not this kind of unilateral tariffs. This is not the way to address that. And also, this hurts our allies. We have a lot more tariffs on our closest allies now than we do on China. Which China, Canada is our number one importer to the U.S. of steel and aluminum, by far much more than China or anyone else. And so, to me, also, it seems like Donald Trump, he focuses on these industries of the past, you know, like the fundamental problem, say, with the steel industry. According to the American Enterprise Institute, in 1980, it took 10.1 person hours to produce a ton of steel. Today, it takes 1.5. I mean, the jobs of the future are not, you're not going to revive your economy by reviving the steel industry. That's not where the jobs are going to be. I mean, if you want to focus on the future of American prosperity, you focus on things like healthcare and tech, not on on steel and coal. And oh, by the way, I don't know if listeners have heard about this, but also the president's thinking about putting together a policy that would order grid operators, electric grid operators, to buy electricity from coal and nuclear plants that are struggling. And I know libertarians just go nuts about this as huge innovation, you know, intervention into markets to, again, to try to prop up a struggling industry. And this is just, you know, goes to show you, I think, that Donald Trump is certainly no free marketer and no conservative.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you said it. So I'm often having to defend that position that Donald Trump is not a conservative. I do think that the China situation is a little different than the Europe in that I think we've got a much legitimate gripe with China, less even about the steel dumping and more about the intellectual property theft. And as you said, the jobs of the future are healthcare, tech, and so forth. And to protect those jobs to some extent, we've got to do something about China.
Well, and
so that said, I understand maybe taking a tougher line with the Chinese to the extent that we're working towards something else. Also, the idea that we don't really have an existing free trade agreement with the Chinese like we do with Canada, Mexico, and you know, for the most part, Europe. So I, you know, my hope is that this is just Trump being Trump, and that next week he will once again reinstitute the waivers and say everyone's come back to the table and we're going to get a terrific deal, and that we don't go further down. My sense is, though, I mean, he's done this before, this kind of brinksmanship, and he's pulled back. So I'm hopeful that he'll pull back here. I don't know that he will or not, but.
Yeah,
I'm hopeful.
Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, I think he has a vision of the world where the United States has the kind of role in the international economy that it did in the 1950s and the 1960s. And that's just not the world of today. I think he vastly overestimates the clout that the U.S. has acting unilaterally. I mean, you know, sure, the U.S. is China's top export market, but it's only 19% of China's total. You know, and China's export market right now, it's around $5.3 trillion. That's much larger than, now the U.S. is number two, but it's much larger than the U.S.'s export market, like $3.5 trillion or so. So in other words, a third smaller than China. So if we want to make China do things, well, we can't make them do anything on our own. This is where multilateral treaties are incredibly important. And for whatever reason, the president seems to have some sort of allergy to multilateral treaties and agreements, which I think that's the future. I think he's stuck in the 1950s and 1960s, and that's just not the way to make America great again.
I would agree that you're right. I've always believed the way to make America great is through more trade and freer trade. So we're on the same page on this one.
Yeah. Now I wonder if we're going to be on the same page. I need more coffee, Jay. The same page on North Korea. Now, as far as we could tell right now, this may change in the next 10 minutes. Who knows? But it looks like the president announced that the June 12th summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un may actually happen now. Now, of course, he can't.
I've heard more. I mean, he's saying it's on.
Well, yeah, but, you know, he said things before. I mean, he canceled the meeting just over a week ago, though, of course, after he canceled it, negotiations continued, both in the U.S. and in Singapore, where the summit's scheduled to be held. And then there were meetings this week between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo with Kim's right-hand man, Kim Jong-chol, who then on Friday delivered a message to President Trump from...
In a really, really big envelope.
Yeah, well which...
Which is awesome. If you've seen the pictures, it's fantastic.
And President Trump said it was a nice message before he actually read it, which he admitted. So there we go. But anyway, after this message came, then President Trump said, yes, the meeting is back on. And then South Korea's leader, Moon Jae-in, has suggested maybe we can get involved in this, maybe the day after the big date on June 12th. So, you know, there's a lot going on there. From my standpoint, I'll believe it when I see it. And June 12th obviously isn't that far off, but right. What do you think? Do you think we're going to end up with a summit on June 12th now?
I do. I do. And if you go back to what I said last week, I feel vindicated in what I said last week, that this is Trump playing negotiating hardball, and it's going to get him back to the table, and it looks as if it has. Again, we got a week to go, so anything can still happen. But in, you know, this sense, this is where I try to square sort of the, you know, what Trump says and what he does, and then what the actual reactions in the world are. Because again, it looks as if he's driving a hard bargain with the North Koreans. We are getting some concession. Now, we don't know everything that was in that letter, or you know, the holdup before was, you know, sort of a precondition was that North Korea would agree to suspend and dismantle its nuclear program. And it was just going to be a question of, you know, when and how quickly and on their side, and then how much protection, assurances of security we could provide on our side. That was sort of the framework. And it seems that framework is back on. So, look, I mean, this is what gives me pause and gives me a little, you know, confusion in terms of on the trade stuff. Is he just blustering like he was before when he canceled the summit and he knows he's going to come back? I hope so. That said, I think this is a good way to deal with somebody like Kim. You don't deal with him by showing any kind of weakness. Now, again, it's different dealing with Kim than, say, dealing with the Canadians.
Well, so. That's what I wanted to ask you about, right? And I think that's a great point you make, because it seems like on the trade issue, our NAFTA negotiations have broken down because what the president and the commerce secretary and so forth have looked for is basically unconditional surrender on the part of the Canadians. Is you will do it our way or we will walk away. And it seems like, and maybe I'm overstating, tell me, but it seems like to the president, everyone who's not America is a potential enemy, basically. And he deals with them all kind of the same, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense. Like you said, you deal with the Canadians very differently than you deal with the North Koreans. But yet I don't see that from this administration.
No, my sense is it's more just, and this is, you know, my completely unprofessional psychological armchair evaluation, this is just how he makes deals, how he negotiates. It's just, this is part of negotiation. You say, I want this, I demand this, my high road, you know, nothing happens, and you walk away, and then you come back. I think it's just his MO, if you will, and he applies it to folks who are really, you know, bad people like Kim, and he also applies it to folks who are generally okay, like the Canadians.
It's like the world is not full of allies and adversaries. It's just full of competitors, basically.
Yeah, I think that's it.
That's so sad.
It's like Donald Trump and not Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate, just on so many levels. You know, another thing I wanted to point out is that in terms of, you know, what the North actually wants here, and you kind of have alluded to this. Obviously, ultimately, they want a reunification of the peninsula under North Korean rule, which I don't think
that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. But one thing that they're not pushing on, that they had pushed on in the past, is removal of U.S. troops. I mean, they want that to happen, but it seems like they're kind of starting with this idea of, well, we'd like to see a peace treaty and kind of, you know, a guarantee of Kim's safety. That would be the number one thing. But it occurs to me that the president's claims that the North will be prosperous if they go along with this, that to me doesn't track, because the only way it seems to me for North Korea to become prosperous, well, I mean, legitimately prosperous, is if they open up their society enough to put Kim in really serious peril because of all the awful stuff he's done. I mean, he's kind of got a tiger by the tail. He can't loosen up. And yet, I don't know that there's never been a society that's been that authoritarian and that closed that could be economically prosperous, I don't think.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, the few exceptions would be places like Iran or Venezuela, where they're able to depend on a big revenue stream from oil, which isn't always as predictable as you'd think it would be. Look, I think what he's saying is, you know, to Kim, is the road to prosperity lies this way. It lies in becoming part of the international order, becoming part of you know, no longer a rogue state, and opening up your country to trade. Now you're exactly right that in the long run, that opening up is going to lead to North Koreans saying, you know, either forget this, I'm getting out, if it's open to the extent that they can leave, or it's going to foment a lot of anger against Kim. I think history is going to show, if you look at, for example, what happened in Germany, which again was even at its most closed, still much more open than what North Korea is now. You're going to have people voting with their feet. To some extent, South Korea and China want to avoid that. There may be some that goes into this transition. You know, who knows with Kim? I mean, maybe they find him a nice island somewhere to sort of Napoleon style to govern on his own and guarantee his safety. I don't know. That my sense would be, you know, we're years down the road from that. But I think you're right. I mean, once you start opening this, and this is something we probably don't talk about enough, but or haven't talked about lately. But there are these bigger forces in history that you see that stuff happens. And going back to the late 80s, early 90s, when the Soviet empire, and I'll use the word empire, started to open up. Once that ball gets rolling, it's tough to contain. You know, I think there are plenty of differences, obviously, between Eastern Europe, which had some experience with democracy before, and North Korea, which hasn't had any experience with democracy really within anyone's lifetime. But no, I think that's the carrot we have to wave in front of Kim is prosperity through opening up. So,
and, you know, some people have, including Donald Trump, have in the past wondered why we're even needed there in that area of the world, you know, that kind of non-interventionist Donald Trump, make America great, that sort of thing. And when you compare the North and the South, I did a few comparisons. It's really pretty interesting, the disparities there. Now, obviously, there's the population. South Korea has almost twice the population, and they're a lot better fed, that's for sure. And it's not like the North has this, I mean, they do have this nuclear capability, which the South doesn't have. But in terms of their, you know, military strength and budget and all that, the South is just this colossus compared to the North. I mean, the GDP numbers were just blew me away. South Korea has the 11th largest economy in the world. And North Korea is they're at 113, which, you know, is not very good, actually. In fact, Jeff,
how many official countries are in the world? Like probably 125-ish or so.
Well, I think there's 198 or something. My wife would know.
Wow.
But the point being is their GDP is $17.4 billion. In other words, Jeff Bezos is worth over seven times more than the entire North Korean economy. I mean, that just you know, that blows my mind that there are 27 individuals that are worth more than North Korea, at least their annual GDP. And this is a sad, poor country that's been run into the ground through decades of horrific Kim leadership, and every Kim seems to be worse than the other one. And you know, I mean, aside from, and this is a pretty big aside from, but this is why I think they'll never give up that nuclear capability, because I don't think that Kim is ever going to be happy with any kind of a rule on Elba, kind of Napoleon type of thing. It's not his safety. He believes, and he's been, you know, born and bred to believe that he, the Kims, are the rightful rulers of a unified Korea. He's not going to give that up. He'd die before he'd give that up. Now, that may end up, you know, coming, happening. But so, and given the fact that without that nuclear threat, they just simply could not keep up in any way with South Korea just because of the economic disparity. And given the fact that he will never open up enough, because to open up that much would mean to almost certainly end his horribly repressive rule. This is, until the Kims are out of the picture, I think this is more or less a no-win situation, the kind of situation that requires careful, calm, incredibly patient diplomacy. And that careful, calm, incredibly patient is exactly the sort of thing that Donald Trump is not. And so while I'm glad that there are going to be talks, it seems like, I am just not terrifically optimistic about this, because I think Donald Trump's exactly the worst type of person to lead us out of this.
See, there, I would disagree. I think maybe this is sort of the Team America axiom, that Donald Trump is exactly the kind of person you need to deal with Kim Jong-un.
Absolutely. And I think he's done it all backwards. I mean, that's the idea that, well, people have this maybe idea of a summit, that these leaders get together and they hash out issues. And that's totally not what summits are. I mean, summits are essentially the stage. Well, not really. They're almost always the stage dressing. All of the real work is done behind the scenes, and how it's been done for, well, now for generations, is that all of the serious negotiation is done before anything is announced, and everyone knows what they're going to agree to, and there might be a little bit of niggling at the edges and so forth, but he's totally flipped this. And I think there's a reason it's done the way it's done, and I think this is just going to end badly. I think from all, I mean, you know, I understand your idea that, well, let's try something different since that hasn't worked, and I've said that in the past myself. Maybe there's something to that, but I just think this is going to be a disaster.
Well, I think you're right. In the terms of the way summits typically work, I think you're absolutely right. If we're talking about regular normal countries, if we're having a summit with the French or the English or the Brazilians or the Israelis or the South Koreans or any regular country that sort of works on the typical norms of the world stage, I think you're right. But in this case, we're dealing with something different. So I think different rules apply.
But different rules being just turn everything on its head and kind of engage in this sort of haphazard on again, off again sort of thing. And you think this is the smart path forward?
So far, so good. Yeah.
So far, so good. Okay.
No, I mean, you say haphazard, and I say this is a thing of North Korea is a entity with which we cannot show any sort of sense of weakness or blink on this, and I think that's different. We can make accommodations if we're talking with other allies and say, sure, okay, we'll agree to this, we'll agree to that. But in this kind of negotiation and over the subject about what we're negotiating, I think we have to be absolutely strong and firm. And if that means walking away or pretending to walk away, then so be it. And I think, look, if you follow up, even after Trump walked away, there were still these back channels that have continued to operate since then. So I don't think it's as haphazard and cowboyish as you'd think. And again, we've had the Secretary of State, who's been involved in high level talks with high level North Koreans throughout the last couple of weeks. And there is the strange stage dressing stuff that Kim had to send Trump a letter in a ridiculously big envelope. So look, there's diplomacy happening. It may not be as the way it usually plays out, but it's happening.
Well, maybe you're right, Jay, and maybe this is a carefully thought out, well considered plan that to me would be not at all in keeping with just about every other single aspect of the Trump administration. But certainly for the sake of world peace and international stability, I hope you're right, but I think you're just entirely wrong on that. But okay. We'll see. We'll see. All right, you know, before we get to our next story, we'd like to thank our newest supporters. First, actually, is a continuing supporter, Dakota, who's been a Patreon supporter for a while, but he recently more than doubled his pledge, writing, "I just wanted to say that I'm loving this new show." And he's talking about the bonus supporter show. He said, "It's not that much extra content, but it feels like a big boost to subscribers." So thank you. We certainly enjoy doing it as well. Yeah. Wow. And on that show, I should point out, I think on our last show, Jay, we talked about, the NFL's new national anthem policy and the Obama signing that production deal with Netflix, I think, was the other thing we were talking about. It was kind of a lot of fun. So anyway, next is Christian, who contributed to the show through PayPal. And Christian has a great email address. I won't read it on the air, but it seems like it's one of those email addresses you think there's got to be a story behind this. And Christian, I just wanted to let you know, if you want to tell me, I'd love to know the story behind that. Anyway, and finally, there's Dimitri, who's our newest sustaining monthly supporter on Patreon. Thanks, Dimitri. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And so, of course, when you make a pledge of financial support, if you have any message you want us to pass along, we're happy to do it. Just let us know. And you can always mail us at mail@politicsguys.com. And, of course, you know, your support is what keeps us going. And if you'd like to get access to that special supporters-only bonus show and join, you know, Dakota, Christian, Dimitri, and all of our great Politics Guys supporters, just go to politicsguys.com/support or just forget about the support part and just click on politicsguys.com and you'll see a Patreon or PayPal link there in the menu. Thanks so much. All right, moving on. You know, Jay, the May jobs report came out on Friday and it was extremely good.
Yay.
Yay is right. The economy added 223,000 jobs, which actually surpassed analysts' expectations. The unemployment rate dropped from 3.9 to 3.8%, which is the level we haven't seen since early 2000. And average worker earnings also rose. They're up 2.7% over the last year. Now, the current economic expansion, this started in 2009. It's now in its 107th month, if I do the math right, which makes it the second longest in modern American history. The only longer one was 120 months from 1991 to 2001. And this is unquestionably good news. But there are a few things some analysts point out. For instance, wage growth is still sort of lagging. The labor force participation rate dropped slightly. It was 62.8% in April. It dropped a tenth of a percent in May. And also, I think it's important to note that the overall growth in the economy over this period in this expansion has been well under 3%, which is considerably lower than it was during that 1991 to 2001 boom. And considerably lower still than like the 5% plus yearly increases we really routinely saw in that so-called golden economic age that stretched roughly from 1945 to 1973. So in other words, not all periods of economic growth are kind of created the same. One final thing I wanted to point out is that President Trump broke with decades of protocol. We could say this about so much. By hinting at a positive jobs report in a tweet that came out just over an hour before the figures were released, which some say is sort of a violation of a federal regulation prohibiting comment on the jobs report before its official release. And of course, the Federal Reserve was already expected to continue its policy of gradually raising interest rates. It's made no secret of that. It's almost certainly going to do so at its meeting later on this month, and markets have been expecting that. So, Jay, what's your take on these economic numbers?
Steady as she goes. I think this is good. I think it's going to get even better. I think the important thing to look at is also this wage growth, which that, again, if you say it's less than it historically has been, this is still, we're seeing more of this uptick in wages than we had in the earlier parts of the recovery. So I think that's a great thing. And something else that of interest is that investment by companies, they're investing now more in technology upgrades, that sort of thing, which is going to further drive productivity, which drives wage growth. So I think this is good news. You and I can argue about whether it's more attributable to Donald Trump or just the 8 years of Obama that just took time to get going. But it's good. And I think it's a good tailwind for the Republicans going into November.
Well, you know, I think certainly Republicans are, and everyone should be happy about these numbers. And in terms of attributing responsibility, I'll say a couple of things. I took a look at the economic growth trend line, and really, it's been pretty steady from 2009 on. So this idea that there's been some kind of a sharp increase under
President. How about the wage growth? But what about the wage growth?
And again, you know, what people are going to do is, and I'm surprised with it coming from you, what people are going to do is decide that government is hugely important in this, and somehow government runs the economy. And I'm really shocked and a little disappointed, Jay, that a conservative like you. Well, here's my point. This is the point I was going to make, is that I think people are far too quick to make these attributions of responsibility for this sort of thing. The economy is so much bigger than the government. And of course, Jay, I know you're not going to disagree with me on this point.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that, no.
No, so, you know, and Republicans are going to say, well, it's Trump's moves toward deregulation and all this, whereas Democrats are going to say, you know what, eventually, just because of the accumulated economic growth, that the pressure on employers to start hiring more and raising wages was inevitable and so forth. And this is an argument that we've had back and forth, well, forever, essentially. And so I'm not going to say this was a delayed Obama-type thing. I mean, I'll point out that, you know, most of the months of this economic recovery were under President Obama. But again, I'm very, very wary about saying this is a Trump boom or Obama boom, or that much bigger boom in the 1990s was due to Bill Clinton or something like
that. And I would say, and I've contended for forever, and probably a lot of people, economists, would hopefully agree with me, that the 90s boom was much more attributable to Bill Gates than to Bill Clinton.
A lot of the tech stuff. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. That a whole new sector of the economy essentially emerged that really hadn't been there before. No, and look, I don't disagree with you on, and you're sort of agreeing with me in that, yes, left alone, the economy will essentially eventually heal itself. Pressure wise for employers to pay more. My point would be the quicker you get the government out of the way, the faster that happens.
Sure. And certain things can help or hurt in various ways. Like if you decide to, you know, I don't know, start a couple wars and spend a few $1 trillion on them, that can definitely have an effect. George W. Bush, talking about you, obviously. But I mean, but yeah, the economy is so much. And that's one thing that, like I said, you and I definitely have agreed on for quite a long period of time, I would say. So, but the bottom line is I don't want to take this good news and make it into a, well, let's try to find a negative.
You're not sick of winning yet.
No, not at all. Not at all, definitely. All right. You know, this week, the Supreme Court declined to hear a challenge to an Arkansas law that requires doctors who provide medication abortions to have a contract with a second doctor who has hospital admitting privileges. Now, Arkansas says this is to ensure the health of the mother in case of complications, and reproductive rights advocates dismiss this as essentially a cover for the law's true purpose, which is to make it more difficult for women to obtain medication abortions. And for those who don't know, this is a two-pill procedure. The first typically is taken at a clinic, and then the second is taken at home somewhere between 6 and 48 hours later. Now, the procedure, which one major study found has a complication rate of less than 0.25%, which is roughly the same for colonoscopies, can be used in the first 9 weeks of a pregnancy. Arkansas currently has 3 abortion clinics, 2 of which offer only these medication abortions. Now, U.S. District Judge Christine Baker initially blocked the law from going into effect after concluding that the medical benefit would be incrementally small, while the burden on women would be substantial, and she called the law a solution in search of a problem. But the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the ruling. They concluded that Judge Baker had failed to make a sufficient factual finding to support her conclusion. And finally, I should point out that 2 years ago, the Supreme Court heard a similar case, and they ruled 5-3 to overturn a Texas law that required doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. And the dissenters in that case were Justices Alito, Roberts, and Thomas. Now, Planned Parenthood says it will continue to work on this and ask a federal judge to stay the execution of the law until an analysis of its effects on women can be carried out. So I think that's where we are now on this, Jay. First off, what does this decision to not hear the case mean, and how do you see this playing out?
I'm not going to read a whole lot into this other than I'm going to say I think the Supreme Court did the right thing for a bunch of reasons. First of all, something that our listeners should know, for the Supreme Court to decide to take a case, they typically need to have 4 votes. And that's not 4 votes to, uphold or overturn. It's just 4 votes that this is something worth taking. So that tells me that the court did not see this as something that was worth taking, at least at this point. And I think that's the other big thing that's going on here. This is largely a procedural issue at this point. And I completely understand the Supreme Court, regardless of where you're coming from on the merits of the case, to say, look, we want a full record before it gets up here. And that's sort of what the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals said. And again, we're getting a little into the constitutional weeds on this. The case was brought as what's called a facial challenge to the law, which carries with it a little bit higher standard of proof. And you have to say, look, there's absolutely no situation in which this law could be valid or constitutional, as opposed to an as-applied challenge, which means that as this law is applied, it's unconstitutional because here are the effects of it. And in Judge Baker's opinion, and this is what the Eighth Circuit sort of chided her for, was she made a lot of sort of assumptions that were just not warranted, or at least had not been found as facts. And they sent it back for her to issue more factual findings. So I think, my sense is this people shouldn't read this one way or another as any sort of commentary on the merits of the law or whether it's eventually going to be held constitutional or unconstitutional. Rather, it's a procedural thing. And I think as a procedural matter, I think both the Eighth Circuit and the Supreme Court did it right, sending it back for additional factual findings.
Yeah, and I agree with you entirely on this. And we're going to get some, I'm sure, some upset folks about this, wondering why I'm agreeing with you on this. But again, and this is such a frustration to me, and I know you share that frustration, where people conflate the procedural and the policy aspects of things. That's frustrating to me, this idea that we need these procedures and it's important to follow these procedures, because I think judicial activism, whether it's on the left or the right, it seems like so many people say judicial activism is fine as long as it's activism on our side, but that's the whole problem with it, because eventually right, it's going to be activism on the other person's side. And so I think issuing a ruling without sufficient findings of fact is never a good idea. And so this idea that these procedures need to be followed no matter what, I think that has to be predominant over whatever my policy preferences are. My bet on this, assuming the court doesn't change in the interim, because who knows, right? But given how the Texas case played out a few years ago, and given what assuming Judge Gorsuch would go the other way with it, it'd still be a 5-4 ruling most likely in favor of the people challenging this law, would be my guess if it got to that point even. And that might make
I think you're right.
Case.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So for those folks who are saying this is, you know, this is going to have very real effects on women in Arkansas if it's allowed to stand, I absolutely agree. And I have, you know, a problem with that, certainly. But I don't know exactly. Let me ask you this, Jay. What? Do you think that Planned Parenthood basically is saying, it seems to me like they're asking for a federal judge to kind of halt this law from going to effect until the case can be heard. Do you think that's likely to succeed? Because that's a different thing than a judge ruling on that facial grounds.
Well, and again, this was brought, and this was a little bit of an unusual procedural circumstance. And that what happened was the plaintiffs went to the federal district court seeking a TRO and a preliminary injunction, saying we don't want this law to go into effect. And at that point, that's how it was immediately appealable. Typically, those types of rulings are not immediately appealable, but they're sort of an exception in these kind of cases. So my sense is what will happen is the Eighth Circuit's ruling, remanding it back for further findings, will take place. The rule at this point will be in effect. The plaintiffs will go back to the court, the district court. We'll have more evidence and more of an evidentiary hearing, and the judge will make those findings. Still, most likely, I think we'll find it unconstitutional and issue a temporary injunction pending a full decision on the merits. So, I think it's going to turn out to be just sort of a do-over at the district court level. And we'll be sort of in the same position that we are now, you know, maybe a year or two down the road. But there's going to be a more complete factual record to base this on.
Yeah. Before we move off this issue, I would like to ask you sort of a broader question on this. It seems to me, and this is coming at it from the left, that a lot of these laws are framed, it seems like they're all framed as being for, you know, medical reasons and so forth. And yet, when a lot of the legislators who passed these laws and governors and so forth talk about them, they talk clearly in religious, moral kind of pro-life terms. And I'm wondering, do you see that as being, of course, it's in a sense, I guess it's obviously hypocritical, but do you see that as being problematic in any way?
Not really. I mean, because if you look at, you know, again, I think you don't have to have, or at least typically you don't have to have, and this is sort of goes to maybe the Trump travel case. You know, intent doesn't really matter whether you're doing this, saying, we believe there's a medically good reason to do it. Now that's important because you have to show there's some sort of, something legitimate there, but I think you could also say there's a legitimate interest in protecting the fetus. Now, the problem you get into there is when you're talking about something like medication RU486, such a morning after pill, essentially, you don't have that same balancing issue of the fetus's right to live. Outweighs the woman's right in that early stage. I mean, the court has said that a fetus has rights after it becomes viable. These would all be sort of by definition pre-viability. So I think to make that argument in court, it wouldn't get you anywhere.
Right. I see what you're saying.
Maybe down the road.
Right. Because fundamentally, many of the people who are pushing for this disagree with that idea that a fetus only has rights after viability, that life begins at conception, and therefore any sort of, in many cases, any sort of procedure that aborts that fetus is essentially murder.
Yeah, exactly. And you're just the courts, that's not what the courts have said, and not what the courts have said for at this point, 30-ish years. So you can certainly make the moral case when you go to court. at least at this point, based on the precedent, you also have to make some other public policy argument for the restriction.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think, I mean, Donald Trump, barring any kind of bizarreness, will be in office for, you know, a few more years at least. And certainly there's a likelihood he's going to be able to appoint one, maybe two more Supreme Court justices. Do you think there's a reasonable chance that the court just might revisit that all and just say, you know what, we're just going to decide that that states have the right to declare that life begins at conception, and so therefore they can, you know, pass any kind of laws based on that fundamental premise? I know the court, it tends to be very uncomfortable with overturning precedent, but if President Trump picks a few people who are kind of hardliners on this, that's the optimistic outcome that the pro-life movement wants. How realistic do you think that is?
This is just my guess. I don't see that happening. This is just a gut feeling. I don't think that it would have to be the right case, the right time to just completely say no more Roe versus Wade. This is all a state state matter. I'm not saying that doesn't happen maybe some point eventually, but I don't see it, you know, coming out of this kind of case. I don't see it coming out right away. And I think judicial conservatives would be wise to not, you know, go with a 5-4 margin on something that big. Again, there's, you know, we talk about this sometimes, that, you know, politics is downstream from culture, and to some extent the law is downstream from culture also. And I think it's, we've lived with Roe versus Wade or some form, whether it's, you know, Casey or something like that, where we've moved back the here's the balancing of the interests. So I think I could see that happening, a change in the balancing of the interests, where something might be upheld that is maybe a little more onerous or closer or maybe even pre-viability. But I just don't see a wholesale departure. Absent, you know, sort of real changes in the court, you know, meaning it would have to be more than a 5-4 decision. I think Roberts would be uncomfortable with the court's legacy in doing that, the court's legitimacy in doing that. You know, take a look at, say, like, you know, Lochner, we talked a little bit about last week. You know, Lochner wasn't just turned overnight. It was one of those, it's sort of like still out there, but it was just, you know, eroded over the years. And I think that's more the model that you would see here.
Yeah, and I think that's a particularly good point about Chief Justice Roberts, because even though he is a conservative, he's I think also in many ways a judicial and political conservative, whereas, you know, certainly Justice Thomas and to a certain extent Justice Alito maybe are a little more comfortable with suggesting more kind of radical, judicially activist type of things than Chief Justice Roberts is. So I think you're right about obviously the judicial conservative type of thing, and I certainly hope you're right about the court not making any kind of wild moves on this.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, Donald Trump, this being a wild move, I don't know how wild this is, but Donald Trump this week issued the fifth pardon of his presidency. This went to conservative provocateur Dinesh D'Souza, who pled guilty to violating campaign finance law by using straw donors to help fund a campaign that violated FEC contribution limits. Now, the president is also reportedly considering commuting the prison sentence of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, a Democrat, who essentially basically tried to sell to the highest bidder, or briber, I guess, the Senate seat that opened up when Barack Obama became president. And President Trump is also reportedly considering granting a pardon to Martha Stewart, who was convicted in 2004 of conspiracy and making false statements to investigators. This was in connection with the securities fraud case.
Right.
Now, of course, Both Blagojevich and Stewart have connections to the president's reality TV career. Blagojevich appeared on The Celebrity Apprentice, and Stewart hosted a sort of a blink-and-you-missed-it kind of spinoff called The Apprentice Martha Stewart in 2005. Now, I think it's also important to point out that unlike previous presidents, and again, we say this about President Trump all the time, but unlike previous presidents, President Trump has not been interested in following the traditional pardon and clemency procedure. And that's where people who seek clemency, they petition through the Justice Department's Office of the Pardon Attorney, they carefully review all the petitions, and then they make recommendations to the president. And finally, I guess I want to note that some are arguing that with these pardons, the president is sending a message. Most of them have some connection to people the president views as his political enemies. It's a big list, obviously. For instance, James Comey prosecuted Stewart.
And rightfully so.
Yeah, well, James Comey prosecuted Stewart. Comey's very close friend, Patrick Fitzgerald, prosecutor Blagojevich, and former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who now has a really interesting podcast, who was also fired by Trump, prosecuted D'Souza. And I think the thinking here is that people like Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen will see this and say they'll get that message and refuse to cooperate with Robert Mueller's investigation. What do you think about this pardon and generally Trump's pardon strategy, Jay?
Here's something that I do find interesting about Trump's pardons is that here we are, he's pardoning people. It's his second year of the presidency. Nobody does that. It's usually you're literally on the way out the door when you pardon all these people, because it's typically not popular to do. But he's doing this and making this. Now, some of his pardons, I think, have been good. Scooter Libby.
Oh, God.
He did pardon Scooter Libby, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, that was an awful pardon.
Some I think have been horrible, like Joe Arpaio. If you look at, and here's the interesting thing, though, with Libby and, say, Martha Stewart, they were both convicted not of actual crime, but of, somehow misleading the FBI or misleading investigators. And there was some of that in Blagojevich also. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I also understand that there might be a statement worth making that, the way that some of these prosecutions have moved forward, where, what you do is you take an investigation, and if you get two conflicting stories and you say, well, I believe this guy over this guy, you've misled investigators. That's sort of, to me, it's a problem when you have more people getting convicted of the misleading investigators, but not really the crime. And in some cases, when there's no crime that actually took place. That's troubling. I see that as government overreach. On Blagojevich, I think there's a little different thing going on. I'd say there's more merit for commuting his sentence, just because his sentence was fairly harsh, considering I think it was, he got like 14 years for what is a nonviolent crime. And some of the conviction was reversed by the Court of Appeals. So I understand something there. There's also a little bit of the weird thing in that this is Trump picking sort of celebrity pardons, because that's just how he operates.
Yeah, and that to me, this whole idea that he has this master plan or something about really anything, that's why I think he picks these celebrity pardons. He does these things impulsively. And we've talked about the whole, is Donald Trump playing 12-dimensional chess, kind of, and so forth. And right. I've always thought that's kind of
probably not.
Yeah, ridiculous, basically. And one thing I do want to point out, and this I think is really kind of a failing of some of the media on the left here. Now, I want to start by saying that I think Dinesh D'Souza is a horrible human being. I think he promotes the sort of thing that the politics guys that both of us disagree with, this sort of, pushing these kind of these hyper partisan ranty sort of things that actually does a lot more harm than good. So the guy did a documentary called the Roots of Obama's Rage or something like that. It's just guy's just a worthless clown as far as I'm concerned. And I think he's a disgusting person. That said, if you take a look at his prosecution, it's hard for me to not reach the conclusion that this was a politically motivated selective prosecution. Normally for the for the sort of thing that he did, normally what happens is you pay a fine, basically. The Obama Justice Department decided to go after him and make an example of him. And I think that was an incorrect move. And so I actually, again, while I think he's a horrible human being, I do think that in this case, the prosecution was not okay, and they pushed for far too much, and that this pardon is, God, I hate to say this, was justified, you know? And again,
good for you. It's a sign of growth.
I'd
make the point that the people most in need of the procedural protections of our justice system are horrible people.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
That's something that you don't think about. And this is something that we sort of get a lot, you know, even when talking about the Trump investigation. And there's sort of this like, yeah, but it's Donald Trump. But to me, that's sort of the whole point of civil rights is that they apply even to the people you really, really don't like. Because otherwise they're not needed. It's the same thing that goes for, you know, the First Amendment is designed to protect speech that's offensive because there's no need to protect inoffensive speech.
Exactly.
I congratulate you on your sign of growth. I agree with you on Dinesh D'Souza right, he may not be a great person, but he was sort of railroaded and overcharged, oversentenced for what he did.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, it's time for what we're reading. So, Jay, you know, before we get to that, one quick thing I wanted to say is, you know, we had planned to do another listener comment episode for our Wednesday show, but with everything that's going on in Asia, North Korea and all that, we decided it would be better to hold off on that in favor of an interview I did with China expert Robert Sutter. Because in addition to being a professor at George Washington University, he's worked with the CIA, the State Department, and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I think it's really a timely thing. I learned a lot from talking with him, including I found out some things that I thought I knew about China and that region are really kind of misconceptions. And so I thought we'd put that up instead there. But as for what I'm recommending this week in terms of reading, there's an article called Mind Control, Barbara Ehrenreich's Radical Critique of the Wellness and Self-Improvement. It's from her book that recently came out called Natural Causes. And it's a fascinating article. It gets into the boomers' denial of death, consumerism, the culture of self-improvement, how exercise has become a form of alienated labor. There's kind of sort of a little bit of a neo-Marxist kind of thread that runs through it. I love that kind of stuff. So it's a great article. I'm actually looking forward to getting the book, and I'm hoping to actually maybe be able to get her on the show to talk about it, because she's written a number of really excellent books over the years, certainly. So,
Jay, well, you know, I've read reviews of the book, and again, it intrigued me because it seemed to be different than the typical Barbara Ehrenreich type thing. That's interesting. What I'm reading, this is terrible. I'm forgetting the author, and I just posted it on the Facebook post page yesterday in National Review, and it was just sort of a guide about civility, and it actually made some recommendations, and these are things we've actually talked about a number of times. That if you want to see more civility in our political system, political discourse, here's how you do it. So it's a good guidelines there, and it's one of those. Look, no one is perfect on this, and it's often a look. Check yourself. If you see a story about your opponent that just seems too good to be true, it maybe is, and think before you go and post this or repeat it. If you hear the story that seems to confirm all of your biases, that's exactly when you need to question the veracity of that story. Also just the idea that, look, lots of stuff happens. No one needs to comment on all of it. It's a strange sort of world now where where all of a sudden, you know, sort of everyone is expected to have an opinion on everything. And used to be you didn't have to. You could just talk about other stuff. And this ties into something I wanted to sort of forgot to mention last week, because the initial part of the article talks about, you know, have things always been this bad? And they make the case of, yes, in fact, they have. And sometimes they're worse. And that was sort of the subject of John Meacham's presentation at the Sixth Circuit Judicial Conference. I don't know if I mentioned that, but you know, Meacham is a historian, written a number of books, particularly one about Andrew Jackson and sort of the Jacksonian age. And his presentation there was sort of the idea that look, America goes through these phases of discord, and it's we work through them, and you know, that's what we need to do, is these things happen as the world changes. It's up to sort of the, you know, Lincoln would say the better angels of our nature to kind of work through this and get over these issues. But, you know, again, both made the point that are we living in divisive times? Sure. Has it been this bad before? Yes. Has it been worse before? Yes. And again, looking at, say, the 1850s, looking at, you know, there's been retrospective on, well, I'm talking about 1850s leading up to the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, of course, because then we ended up having a Civil War. But you know, to your point, also, people, if you do any reading about the history of, for instance, the labor movement, there were an awful lot of clashes that were just shockingly violent. And this is even in the early to, you know, early 20th century, 1920s and 1930s and so forth. And it's really some. And also, if you take a look at the history of the 60s and 70s, the you know, that just came up in my interview with Tyler Cowen, the number of bombings and things like that was just like, wow. So it's not that things are worse today. It's just that we hear more of the bad things more quickly through social media.
Well, you know, and there was another piece, and I'm forgetting. It's just been a crazy week. I forget what I read or where I read it. But again, they're talking about, we're sort of having this 50-year retrospective on the year 1968. And again, if you think things are bad now, take a look back to what was happening in 1968 and the pace at which it was happening. That was really one crazy summer when you went through, you know, assassinations and then riots at the convention and riots in the streets. And it was almost a weekly occurrence that one of these things would happen. So, no, things aren't great now, but they've been worse before, and we'll get through this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, folks, it's been kind of a long, discursive show, but that's okay every once in a while. But if you have not yet had your fill of us, in a few minutes, we're going to be starting our supporters exclusive after show, or is it the Politics Guys After Dark? I forget what we're calling it now. But and this week, I'm hoping that we can get into the Roseanne Samantha Bee controversies. And also, I don't know if you heard, Jay, but Illinois recently ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. I'm sure you'll have some interesting things to say.
I'm woman, hear me roar, yes.
Say about that. And I'm sure you have some stuff lined up as well. So anyway, that show and our previous bonus shows are available to all of our great financial supporters. All right. And also remember that if you have filled out the survey, thank you so much. If you haven't yet, it's at survey.libsyn.com, libsyn.com/politicsguys. We'd really appreciate it. And also that link will be in the show notes. And that is it for us. If you want to get in touch with us, you know how to do it. It's mail@politicsguys.com. And hey, if you want to help us keep the show going, you know how to do that too. politicsguys.com/support. And our Facebook page, we've had a really busy, and I think it was a great week on Facebook, facebook.com/politicsguys page. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us.